Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Few men I know, and that I know of, have rendered more and more distinguished service, certainly in recent memory, in that war for the free world, than our first guest. I couldn't be more delighted to say his name is Mike Pompeo. He has served our country in a variety of capacities, beginning with his time at West Point in the U.S. Military Academy. He graduated first in his class, went on to be a very distinguished Army officer, the successful businessman from Kansas that set up his run for Congress, in which he served for several terms from Kansas, and then on to become the director of Central Intelligence Agency under Donald Trump and his Secretary of State. These days, he is a distinguished fellow at the Hudson Institute, has been a friend of mine, I'm proud to say, for quite a number of those years, and it is a delight to have him back with us on Secure Freedom Radio. Mr. Secretary, thank you for joining us.
Frank, thanks for having me on this morning. It is indeed good to hear your voice and to be back with you today after so many years fighting for freedom alongside each other. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's an honor to be at your side from time to time, and I hope we'll be at that position more in the future. Let me ask you, sir, you have the distinction of having served in an administration that accomplished really remarkable things in your portfolios during its time in office. It must pain you almost beyond imagining to see that the legacy that Donald Trump and you bequeathed to this administration on so many fronts, just to enumerate a couple that I'd like you to speak to, the practice of peace through strength, the actual rebuilding of important alliances like NATO, the setting back on their heels our adversaries like China and Russia and Iran, and the remarkable accomplishments in the Middle East with Israel, both in a bilateral relationship and the Abraham Accords, a border secured and a wall, a building, on so many different fronts, sir. There was real accomplishment, yes, but also real security. And it's been squandered. It's been, well, decimated, I think, is a perhaps better term for it. And I just would ask you to reflect on both the substance, if you would, and a little bit of how it makes you feel, having worked so hard to accomplish all of that.
Frank, you know, we did work at this, and you used the term real security. This is how we approached it. It wasn't about fancy parties and having climate summit. It was about trying to deliver, shorthand America first, right? Trying to deliver real benefits, prosperity and stability and peace, and conflict reduction every place we went. It's not personal legacy that, frankly, just when I read the newspaper, I find just disturbing. It's that the risk has gone up in just these last 13 months for our soldiers sailing around the world and our soldiers wherever they may be. But to those of us here who are in the United States trying to take care of our families, going to church and doing the right thing, now the risk to our nation and the American way of life have increased. And if you said what bothers me, what is it that just, you said, you, I think you may have said frustration or must be a real downer. It's not about preserving what our administration did, what President Trump and I did. It's the outcomes that will flow from these decisions of American weakness and the risk that is created associated with it that is painful to observe, because I know these things have real world impacts, certainly on America, but on our friends around the world as well.
Forecast a little bit what that looks like. We're going to talk a bit more momentarily with Claudia Rosette, who I know you know well, about this Xi Putin axis that was formalized in a statement last week. What do you think the world looks like as these enemies are emboldened and empowered, and America clearly regarded as, well, perhaps a paper tiger, or at least not an effective impediment to their ambition.
So Xi and Putin together are a formidable pair. There's always been footsie played there. I think a little bit of this was propaganda. They have their places where they'll end up at each other's throats as well. But your larger point, which is the dictators, the folks who don't permit people to worship in the way they want, who don't value human life, who frankly are running operations like the Russian oligarchy or the Chinese Communist Party or the theocracy in Iran or the terrible leadership in North Korea, their little cabal, those are folks who feel emboldened today because the United States, not because the United States won't send the 82nd Airborne every place. We weren't, that wasn't our model either. Our model was to use the American tool set, our innovation, our prosperity, our capacity to convene parties and say, no, we're going to go solve this problem together, and to deny them the space, the bad guys, the space to do the things they want to do around the world. That takes American leadership. And when we're not prepared or capable of doing that at the most senior levels of America's government, then the bad guys will roam, move about the cabin, right? The Southwest Airlines tagline, feel free to move about the cabin. I think they can see whether it was the debacle of the way in which we departed Afghanistan, or even we forget the from Russian soil, we had U.S. gasoline pipelines in the southeast of the United States shut down for days. And our president went and met with Putin and said, don't do that again. That is a green light for minor incursions, major incursions, incursions of every stripe, not only military incursions, but incursions on the freedom and rights respecting part of the world that the United States has been the guardian of for so long.
When you were in office, I think it's fair to say you characterized the Chinese not as a competitor, not as a rival, but as an adversary, if not out and outright as an enemy. And you worked with the president to treat them accordingly. The tariffs, notably, that helped enormously in trying to reset our trade relationships. But also, you were really at the forefront in the administration, I think it's fair to say, in terms of trying to do what my old boss Ronald Reagan did to the Soviet Union, which was restrict, if not cut off, the cash flow that was enabling it to be a formidable threat to us. I remember vividly your remarks before governors, I think back in February of 2018, where you really warned them that they were being targeted to provide this kind of cash flow and support and be targeted in the process. So talk a little bit about China, where we are with it today, the Olympics underway now, lifting it up. What is happening? What should we be doing?
Your analogy to the Soviet Union is a good one. The clear and present danger to the United States that the Chinese Communist Party presents is, in my judgment, even greater than the one that the Soviet Union presented because of the Chinese economic capacity that the Soviet Union never had, even at its peak. They are not a competitor. The United States competes with Canada and Norway. Right, the Chinese Communist Party is an adversary, and whether we want to acknowledge that or not, I can assure you Xi knows that and is acting in accordance with that, and has for an awfully long time while we turn the other cheek. And so our efforts were different and manifold and cross-disciplinary. So we wanted to make sure we had a military that was capable of confronting the challenges China presents in the cyber domain, in the space domain, and in the more traditional kinetic domains. We wanted to make sure that we were there. In the economic space, we wanted to make sure that American technology, American semiconductor manufacturing, American AI had the capacity to shape how the economy would run for this next century, one that needs to be an American century. And then finally, and you referred to this, money and the Chinese United Front. So folks would know the money challenge. If the Wuhan virus taught us anything, it was American economic dependence on China is really risky, really dangerous for Americans all across our country. If you have a job in Wyoming, or you're working in the outskirts of Chicago in Illinois or Wisconsin somewhere, the fact that they've stolen your intellectual property, they've now moved it to China, and they may not sell it back to us the products back to us when we need them most should be something that every person across America understands. This is a deeply domestic issue. The second issue that impacts every American is the so-called Chinese United Front, right? This is their efforts inside the United States. I spoke to the governors about it. I hope your listeners will all take this on board. When the Chinese Communist Party shows up at your PTA meeting with a check for a new jungle gym or a swing set, that is not because they love you. It is because they want a friend when we, in fact, do the things we need to do to confront the Chinese Communist Party. And when the state of, pick a state, I don't even want, the state of Pennsylvania has their pension fund investing in technology in China that could well be used one day to kill your son or your cousin or your friend in kinetic warfare that the Chinese Communist Party conducts against the United States, that's deeply immoral and certainly dangerous. We have to make sure that we use our economic tools to confront the United Front effort, the espionage effort that the Chinese Communist Party is conducting inside the United States, to confront them every day. We made one good step. We closed a massive spy operation that was being conducted out of the Chinese diplomatic facility in Houston, Texas. It was the right thing. I wish we'd have done it sooner, and I wish we'd have been able to do it even more broadly. This is something that affects every single American across the country. I love my Chinese American friends and brothers. The Chinese Communist Party presents an even more clear and present danger to them than it does to the rest of us, because they will chase them and their family members back home in ways that none of the rest of us suffer that risk.
And try to exploit that as leverage to make them do Beijing's bidding. And I want to just say a quick word about one great friend of yours, a Chinese American by the name of Miles Yu, who rendered alongside you tremendous service in the State Department. And I really commend you for having his counsel, I know, on an ongoing basis now at the Hudson Institute.
He's a good friend and a anti-communist fighter for freedom extraordinaire.
He is indeed, all of that. Mr. Secretary, let me turn to Iran as another place that the legacy of the Trump-Pompeo team has been squandered. And it seems to me really done in a manner that is not just counterproductive, but really quite insulting in a way. Would you reflect on that?
I must say on this, Frank, I am befuddled. I often can articulate someone who thinks differently than me. I can articulate their logic path, and we might have different preferences or priorities, and so we come to different conclusions. On this one, I must say, it is just unexplainable to me. It is unexplainable to me that the stability that had been built out through the Abraham Accords, we had good Arab partners that recognized the right of Israel to exist. The deep connectivity that we had built out with our friend and ally Israel, it was important that we move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. It was important that we recognize the Golan Heights as the rightful real estate belonging to the state of Israel. Those were good things that not every occupation, not every settlement rather was illegal, and that Israel's not apartheid or an occupying force. Those were important, but more broadly, we'd set a model that had isolated the Iranians and imposed real costs on them. And this is where on January 20th at noon of 2020, the administration found itself, and they instead of saying that's the right trajectory to keep America safe, to protect America, and to protect the United Arab Emirates and Israel and the Saudis, instead of that, they said, nope, we had this deal, and it's really important that we go bring honor to the deal that we struck, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. President Obama did that, and so we're going to go do that again. The world had moved on. And yet, today in Vienna, they are about to sacrifice American security on the altar of this JCPOA. It's literally an article of faith. It's not a treaty. It's not an executive order. It's a press release that they now clutch. And they clutch it in a way that will allow Iran to have a nuclear capability that will put Israel in an incredibly difficult place and will create a set of incentives for other Arab states to build out their nuclear programs as well. That proliferation risk is real and dangerous and serious.
It seems to me we are at the cusp of war in that region, and it probably won't be confined to it, alas, because of the character of the regime in question. Mr. Secretary, I wanted to just touch on one other topic with you before turning to a sort of closing observation. You've mentioned Russia several times. Obviously, Ukraine is feeling the hot breath of Vladimir Putin at the moment. The administration seems completely unmoored on what to do about this. On the one hand, it makes noises about opposing any invasion. On the other, it makes clear there will be little done to actually impede that should it occur. What are your thoughts on the importance of Ukraine to the West? Are you of the view, as some of our friends are, that we have no interest here and there's essentially no difference between Russia and Ukraine? And more to the point, sir, what would you recommend we be doing at the moment?
So Ukraine and the Ukrainian people are not Russian people. They often have Russian heritage, and some of them would be preferred to be part of Russia. But for the most part, the good people of Kyiv and other parts of Ukraine want their own country and their own democracy. It's the decision that was made when the Soviet Union dissolved, and they continue to believe that. We do have interest there. Between Western Russia and Eastern Ukraine, they provide wheat to the United States and the world. A third of all red winter wheat moves through the Black Sea. So we think it's a long ways away. In fact, it is. But in the reality, this will drive bread prices, right, on your kitchen table in my hometown of Wichita, Kansas, or in Florida or in Oregon. We have an interest there. It's not the case that we need to send big troop forces to Ukraine to defend the Ukrainians. We should provide support to them and enable them to impose real costs on Russia. If you step back just half a step from this, Frank, and I think this is important, the deterrence cap, the deterrence model of peace through strength that the Trump administration had and that we took on from the idea that Reagan bestowed to us, that when that deterrence cap is lifted, this is what you see. I don't know what Putin decides, right? He's moved 100,000 plus soldiers to the West. He's got huge equipment stocks in Belarus. The Poles, the Romanians, the Baltic countries are all very worried about what comes next. I don't know what Putin will decide, but I know this. He wouldn't do this if he believed that the United States would stand with its friends and partners and provide, forget military or personnel, just the moral clarity that the United States has always demonstrated. If we did those things, Putin would be much more cautious in the way that he acted. I can prove it. For 4 years, he didn't do this. And Putin hasn't changed. What changed was the American administration. And that, thus the change in Putin's behavior. He was the same guy during our time that he is during Biden's time. What changed was the American administration and the way that it dealt with him.
Unfortunately, I think you can say that of every bad guy on the planet, and we're going to reap the whirlwind if we're not careful. Which brings me to the last topic, sir. As I mentioned earlier in introducing you, you served in uniform in the United States Army. I know you've retained your bonds with those with whom you served and the service and the military more generally. I'm very alarmed at what is being done to our armed forces at this moment of great and growing peril, in part because of the changes that we've just discussed. Most immediately, sir, I had an interview on this program last Thursday with a Marine Corps combat veteran officer still serving, about the condition of not just his service, but the armed forces more generally in the face of the vaccine mandates and the ideological, well, indoctrination and purging, and more generally, the hollowing out of our military, in strong contrast to what you all did in terms of trying to restore peace through strength. We now have evidence that the damage being done specifically by these vaccines is being doctored to obscure just how much damage has been affected. And I just wonder if you would reflect on the, Don Rumsfeld's statement about you go to war with the army you have. This is the only military we have, sir. Are you concerned that it is, well, perhaps in extremis, not just not the deterrent we need it to be, but in real danger of being at risk of unable to serve the security needs of our nation?
And Frank, this is a deep question, a very important question. I'm very worried about trajectory. We can debate where it is an absolute value, whether that's the Navy's capability, right? Fewer ships today than there were, and no plan to get it to the right level. recruiting challenges, all the things that are the nuts and bolts. But your point is a even deeper one, more important one. I had the incredible privilege to be a young lieutenant in the Reagan heyday. I graduated from West Point in 1986. We had the resources, the money that we needed to do our mission to fight and win America's wars. But more importantly, we had a cultural backstop, which was a president of the United States who understood how to effectively deploy and support and defend those young soldiers that worked for me. And that was not just true in the Army, it was true in the Navy and the Marines and the Air Force as well. We now have taken this military and we've laid over it a model, which is a woke model. And that's too glib and too short, but it is a model that has moved away from the core mission set, right? To break things and to be a force and a power so that America's Secretary of State, my successor or me, had the ability to show up and they knew what was in behind him, right? They knew it was a capable fighting force, able to deliver. And, you know, we demonstrated this, right? No other nation could have delivered what we did when we struck Qasem Soleimani, right? Thousands of miles away, a pinpoint strike against a moving target the complexity of that. There's no military in the world that could have executed that. To lose that on the altar of some other idea about equity, right? Sign me up for equality. Sign me up for giving everybody the meritocratic chance to go compete and be successful. If they want to serve, I want them serving too.
Exemplified by the United States military
for decades, Frank. Yeah. Exactly. And to walk away from that and say, no, the mission set has got to be something different. We're going to underwrite the diversity and inclusion office to the expense of a submarine development. These are huge mistakes that are difficult to turn away from. And so I'd tell everybody who's in the military who's listening today, make sure when you talk to your leaders, do that right. Do that well. Make clear that you joined, you became a soldier or a sailor or now part of our space force for a reason. You wanted to be part of the world's most capable fighting force. And you're happy to have brothers and sisters from all across America participate in that, from every background, from Appalachia to Los Angeles, from African Americans to Caucasians. We don't care what faith you are, but we wanted to be good at their job. And I want the person standing next to me in that tank to be able to load that tank round. I want the person sitting at the computer terminal who's going to drive our mission set to make sure that the missile fires appropriately, who's repairing our equipment. I want them to be world-class. And if we lose that mission focus, if we trade it for something else, if a president of the United States does what Joe Biden did, what President Biden did, and stands in front of his soldiers and says, climate change is going to be the biggest battle of your life. This is not in America's best interest. It is not in the best interest of our servicemen and women who risk their lives for us. And it will put America in a very precarious place, Frank.
I couldn't agree more, and I couldn't have said it better. This is a moment when we have to get this right. It would be a mistake to do this to the United States military under any circumstance, I think it's fair to say. But under these circumstances, in part brought to us by serious mistakes that have been made consistently by this administration, I will say, if you won't, squandering the legacy of what you bequeathed to them, sir. It is of the most fraught character, the environment that they're creating. And we look to, I hope, course correction in the months to come. Your willingness to speak up, among other places, on this platform is deeply appreciated, and I hope you'll do so again.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, my friend. God bless you, sir. Claudia Rosette, up next.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. Her name is Claudia Rosette. She is one of our country's most skilled and accomplished and acclaimed investigative journalists. She has worked for outfits like the Wall Street Journal, both as a reporter and as an editorialist. She is a remarkable resource these days at the Independent Women's Forum, where she is their journalist in residence, foreign policy fellow, I think is the formal title. And she has been actively contributing throughout this period as a really very wise, very knowledgeable contributor to the public policy debate. And I am always grateful for her joining us for that purpose here at Secure Freedom Radio. Claudia, welcome back. It's good to talk with you.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for that generous introduction.
Well, heartfelt and deserved in this case. Let me talk to you, Claudia, first about the product of two countries that you've spent most of your life reporting on for various periods living in. The statement that was issued last week by Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, and Vladimir Putin, the dictator of Russia. What was that about? What does it entail? And what does it portend?
Effectively, it was, without actually declaring war, it was an announcement that they are actively seeking to subvert the liberal order that the U.S. has been at the head of since the end of world, since we won World War II, and replace it with the order of Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin, of dictators. In fact, the declaration, it's the statement, which was the whole setting, Frank, was spectacularly ominous. Just before the opening of these Olympics, where the two of them looked down on the token Uyghur lighting the cauldron and the masked, the dehumanized masked athletes socially distanced, thanks to the virus that actually emerged from China, but now China blames the rest of the world, and so on. The statement it states in the headline, entering a new era. That's their era they're talking about, and the global sustainable development, because they are flogging the idea of development as something where they now lead, basically co-opting everything that America has led in the ways in which we've benefited the world. They're now claiming for themselves, and they're saying, we're leading the way.
You know, it struck me as not only a very ominous document, as you have indicated, Claudia Rosette, but a very cynical one. At that, it starts off by espousing human rights and democracy, in their parlance, of course. What do you make of this sort of nod in the direction that these are important issues for the rest of the world? Is this simply a classic bait and switch on the part of these tyrannies, or do they have some actual commitment to either human rights or democracy or both, just defined a little differently than the way the rest of us do?
Defined a lot differently. It's bait and switch in the sense that they are taking all these familiar labels to us that stand for very, very important ideas, the basis of our system, democracy, and completely redefining it. In fact, it's redefined in a way that's not well defined. It's amorphous enough so they can make it mean whatever they want it to mean, which is sort of the sickening premise at the core of communist rule, among other things. And while neither Russia nor China today is communist in the way that they were in the last century, they still have this Leninist party structure, interest in control. Putin is basically styling himself as the czar of the revived Russian empire, and it's turning into a very ugly business, as Ukraine can tell you. Xi Jinping is styling himself as the emperor of this so-called rejuvenated China, where if you look at the Olympics, and I understand why people are boycotting them, I watching them in the same way I used to read Pravda. If you look at this,
professional duty calls.
Yeah, so it's pretty much the grim scene of people, it's well summed up, people going around in face masks. Their family can't be there. They're in this closed loop bubble. Everything, why are they even in China at all? It's fake snow in a place where it doesn't snow enough for these Olympics. And they're all in China. This is all to the glory of China. The athletes are having their own Olympics in their way. They're competing as best they can on the fake snow. But they're accessories to this display of what Xi and Putin style as these rising empires that will dominate the world and bring us their brand of what they're calling democracy. It's dictatorship and develop, which is they decide what develops and you make it. That's how this actually works.
They will use Chinese labor, I think you mean, to make it. They will finance it on your backs. They will foreclose on the loans when you fail to make your payments. And they will use whatever they've built for the colonial empire of China, which is what the Belt and Road Initiative really seems to be all about, isn't it? Then there's the section that I thought was particularly interesting as sort of a long time national security professional, and I know you follow closely too. What did you make, Claudia Rosette, of the statement that both the Russians and the Chinese are intent on reducing the importance of nuclear weapons in the security arena, and that they are going to forswear weaponization of space or attacks on, or I should say, and attacks, assets in space. And then the one that was a real kicker, as far as I was concerned, was they swore their undying loyalty to the Biological Warfare Convention, which bans the biological warfare programs that they both have illegally, and that, as you say, Claudia, produced in the case of China, it appears, this Chinese Communist Party virus.
Well, but this is classic. They do this. They've been doing this for decades. They, what they are after is conventions via the UN or pledges that involve us, in which everyone says there will be no more nukes, there will be no more, all these nice constraints. And then only we are bound to observe them, because in a dictatorship, they don't answer to their people. So they overrun it. In fact, right now, they're calling for these things, but they're making more nuclear weapons. China has said it's going ahead. And you get in this context of the virus, where we don't have absolute proof, but there's a mountain of circumstantial evidence that it came from the laboratory in Wuhan. They're announcing that they now want all these constraints on biowarfare. Chemical weapons, that's a hoot. Russia has been abetting Syria over the in recent years on the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime against Syria's own people. Remember, that's why President Trump was carrying strikes on the chemical weapons facilities in Syria. And so all of these things are just, it's through the looking glass over and over. It's projection, which I would note, and I don't think this is a crazy comparison, was a hallmark of how Adolf Hitler operated. Endless projection. What you're doing, you blame on the other side. And in this case, they also pledged, quote, no limits on their partnership with each other. That's a lie, too. Vladimir Putin, who is the secondary power in this duo, has got to be eyeing Xi Jinping, where they're cooperating now because they are both hostile to the free world. They need us out of the picture to proceed with this plan. But there's got to be a very interesting endgame out there if that's where this goes, because Russia is a treasure house of resources, sparsely populated, and China is full of, some 1.4 billion people crammed in right next to it, looking at that. So we are, what rolls ahead from this statement, if the U.S. and its allies do not step up and do whatever it takes to deter this from going ahead, is a very bad century.
I want to come back to that point about what we need to do here with you in just a moment, Claudia, because it's absolutely vital, of course. One other point about this statement and the positioning of the two leaders is China professed its support for what Russia is doing vis-a-vis NATO, which most immediately, as you know, and you mentioned, means Ukraine. For their part, the Russians have professed their willingness to support the Chinese on Taiwan, ensuring that it is not independent of China ever. These seem to be prescriptions, Claudia, for war. And I think you've indicated that they're preparing for it, that's for sure. Do you read it that way? And if so, would you anticipate that should it come to that, whichever one goes first, the other will follow suit, as well might their various allies in North Korea, in Iran, Pakistan, perhaps, some even suggest Turkey?
Unfortunately, Frank, that's exactly how I read it. That is what they're preparing for. That's what they're building up their militaries for. That's what the hypersonic missiles are about. And as our own State Department likes to say, and I really don't like this phrase, of course they do have we have a choice. They're going to present us with a choice, which is we can surrender. We can just let them go ahead without having to fight, which would be truly terrible, or we go to war. That's where this is going. And what needs doing, we keep listening to the State Department talking about, and President Biden, the White House, that we need to create diplomatic off-ramps for Putin. He has a choice. Well, Putin doesn't need us creating diplomatic off-ramps. He created the entire crisis over Ukraine. That's coming from him. You know, he can find an off-ramp if he wants to. Let him present us with off-ramp. The problem is we're not providing them with any persuasive incentive to stop.
Yeah, deterrent.
Instead, we're doing things like, yeah, exactly, a deterrent. Instead, we're producing things like Nancy Pelosi's America, quote, Competes Act, which purports to be about confronting China, stopping China, but in fact is this huge peon to the woke left-wing agenda that would cost America, damage America, and isn't actually going to hurt China. So we're hurting ourselves. They're happy to let us keep doing that.
What exactly does it do, if not enhance our ability to compete with China?
Okay, first, Frank, it's 2,900 pages long. This is another one of these Pelosi packages where I think she wants us to pass it so we can find out what's in it. But if you sample it, and some have done so, and I've looked through some of it, what you see is there's chicken feed in there that's aimed, it sounds good, about dealing with China. You know, there are some things marked for trying to help Hong Kong, for trying to call out China on various things. The problem is that is completely overwhelmed. That's the bait. It's completely overwhelmed by this giant agenda of social engineering, critical race theory, union pandering, climate pork. It goes on and on about looking for common ground with China on climate. That is really a bad direction to go. China has already completely snookered the American elite on climate, where the idea is we will pay huge costs up front. And this is assuming you buy the whole climate argument anyway. Yeah, I'm quite skeptical that our problem is carbon emissions. I think it's pollution, but of a different kind. And that's something that development tends to address anyway. We adapt because we have free markets and so on. But if you accept the whole climate premise, then what China has done is given these airy promises that, you know, by 2030, it will have peaked its carbon emissions. By 2060, it will be net zero. Frank, that's a time frame where we're talking about promises from a country that's never going to happen. We're talking about promises from a country that is violated systematically, China's part, you can throw Russia in if you like, one agreement after another, one of the big in-our-face things being the promises for Hong Kong, which is just being, the soul of that city is being destroyed right now by China, despite the international treaty deposited with the UN, guaranteeing rights and freedoms for many years to come. And that's
two
the way
systems,
all of this
one
works.
Country and all of that.
Yeah, precisely.
Claudia, I appreciate so much, as I always have, your clear-eyed understanding of the world we're in, the challenges it poses to us, and your courage in talking about what we need to be doing to protect our vital interests and our people in the face of them. Thank you for what you do at the Independent Women's Forum these days, and for joining us from time to time. I hope we'll have you back very soon with updates. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Godspeed. Next up, Robert Spencer joins us. We'll talk with him about jihad and what we best be doing about that as well. Spoiler alert, it's not following Pope Francis' guidance. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, joined by Robert Spencer, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, among many other distinctions. He is notably the founder and driving force behind jihadwatch.org, indispensable online resource, the author of, 23 books at last count, including The Truth About Muhammad. He is an essayist of great renown, among other places, with columns at Front Page Magazine and PJ Media. He is a great friend and very much admired colleague, and we're always delighted to have him with us. Welcome back, Robert.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
I wanted to hit a couple of things with you that you've been focused on, Robert. And let me just say, your site, jihadwatch.org, is a running commentary on, as well as depiction of, the state of the jihad against us around the world, with a lot of anecdotes and reporting from literally every continent, I think, about rapes and beheadings and murders and other acts of violence in the name of Sharia that have been perpetrated and are being perpetrated. It makes all the more extraordinary the sorts of things that are being done in the name of interfaith dialogue that seemingly give a complete pass to such behavior. Give us a little bit of the flavor of how this works in practice, Robert, and specifically, if you would, the role that is being played in this industry, if I can call it that, by Pope Francis, the head of the Catholic Church.
Frank, interfaith dialogue, to be blunt, is simply a means of dawah, Islamic proselytizing, for the Islamic side, and a mechanism to compel or intimidate Christian leaders into being afraid to speak about Muslim persecution of Christians for fear of harming the dialogue. Pope Francis is the foremost example of this. And in a recently he issued a video message on the third anniversary of his Declaration on Human Fraternity for World Peace and Living Together, which he signed with the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar, the foremost institution in Sunni Islam, Ahmed Al-Tayeb, in 2019. Now, he said, "This is a good day to extend a hand to celebrate our unity in diversity," and hailed the success of the dialogue that he's having with the Grand Sheikh of Al-Azhar. Meanwhile, however, he did not mention the fact that Christian persecution, the Muslim persecution of Christians specifically, is continuing and even stepping up in force in places such as Nigeria, Pakistan, and elsewhere, and that the dialogue has not only not prevented one Christian from being persecuted or one church from being destroyed, but it has prevented Christian leaders in the West from speaking about this persecution, once again, for fear of harming the dialogue.
So you're saying this is a technique, essentially, interfaith dialogue, for want of a better term. And it is a preferred term, I think it's fair to say, by the Muslim Brotherhood and others like it. We have a serious challenge on our hands in that these are individuals who are, and institutions for that matter, that are dominating the perceptions of Islam and Sharia, especially Sharia supremacism, I would argue. And it's a canard, basically, being used to subvert us and silence us in the process. Is that basically the thrust of what you're saying, Robert?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You take, for example, the great Muslim Brotherhood theorist Sayyid Qutb, who wrote that the idea of building bridges with non-Muslims is to give them a bridge to cross over into Islam. It is not, in other words, a genuine give and take or any kind of mutually respectful exchange. It is only meant to bring the non-Muslims into Islam. Meanwhile, the Christian leaders who are pursuing this dialogue, foremost among them the Pope, have never acknowledged, never, that this is the objective, have never attempted to try to understand some of the motives of the people that they're dealing with. And so they have no idea whatsoever what they're really getting into or what its implications are. And all it's doing is preventing them from saying anything critical or that might even be perceived as critical about Islam. And consequently, they are criminally silent about the Muslim persecution of Christians.
Robert, the role of the Pope in all of this is particularly concerning because this is not the only place in which it seems as though he is, well, betraying his faith or at least the duties of his office. He is also engaged, as I think you know, with the Chinese Communist Party in subverting the Catholics in China and essentially enabling those who seek to persecute them or at least dominate them, namely the Chinese Communists, to have their way. With his permission. And so it seems as though there's a sort of systemic failure here on the part of one of those who you would expect will be at the forefront of the efforts to safeguard not just Christians, but Christendom against those who have historically, and even at this very moment, been pretty clear. They seek to force its submission, if not its extermination.
You know, it's really a shameful record that Pope Francis has amassed in regard to China. There was for years an underground Catholic church in China that maintained communion with Rome, while the Chinese Communist Party set up a Catholic church that was more autonomous and more, in other words, under their direct control. And instead of standing by the Chinese Catholics who had suffered so greatly for so many years, the Pope swiftly repudiated them a few years back and signed an agreement recognizing the Chinese Catholic polity. Now, that was just an extraordinary betrayal of people who had suffered for the faith that the Pope is supposed to be upholding. And since then, it's just gotten worse in terms of his rapprochement with the Chinese Communist Party. This Pope seems to have no regard for the difficulties of Christian believers of all denominations in totalitarian states, and is ready to betray them at the drop of a hat.
Yes, it is, as you say, a shocking record, to be sure. Is there any end in sight with all this, Robert? Do we see the Biden administration or, well, the Pope, or anybody recognizing that what's happening here is a pretty unbroken record of failure to contend with the reality that not all Muslims, arguably in China, not all Chinese, for that matter, are enemies of the Christian faith. But those in charge, whether it's in, you know, the Islamic world or whether it's in certainly communist China, are very much so. I'm just wondering, are we learning any lessons, would you say, from these hard experiences?
No, I think just the opposite, Frank, unfortunately. The Biden administration is pursuing a path of appeasement, for example, with the Islamic Republic of Iran, lifting sanctions on the Islamic Republic with absolutely no give and take, nothing given in return. And it's the same thing with the Chinese Communist Party and the Biden administration. It's always appeasement and concessions to the totalitarians instead of confrontation with them. And so this is, in a sense, the same thing that the Pope is doing, that there doesn't seem to be any will to stand up to tyranny or to note that it's tyranny at all.
Something that, again, Robert Spencer, I can't thank you enough for your clarity and your courage in holding up the mirror to these abject failures and the dangers associated with them. Speaking of which, let me ask you about a very interesting comparison between how those who are aligned with this sort of Sharia supremacism and those who have been, shall we say, more robust in standing up for freedom in general are treated in and by, you know, America's media and more generally by our political class. You've written a piece at PJ Media about Mehdi Hassan, featured star and host of MSNBC, and contrasted him with the treatment that a wildly popular podcaster by the name of Joe Rogan has been treating at the hands of the left and its cancel culture, as it's called. Walk us through that, Robert, and why this is of consequence for a nation like ours that is beset increasingly by these forces of the left. We've come to call them, as I think you have, the red-green axis, communists and Islamists sort of making common cause to the end of, well, our republic, I think it's fair to say.
Well, you know, Frank, there's an all-out war on the freedom of speech. I wrote a book about it for the Center for Security Policy last year, and it's picking up in energy and impetus. And there is an increasing effort to silence those who dissent from the establishment line. Joe Rogan has been targeted for questioning the orthodoxy about the COVID pandemic and how to deal with it, despite the fact that everyone is really feeling their way along on this, and nobody can be entirely sure of what works and what does not, and so on, and what's effective and what isn't. Rogan offered some unorthodox solutions that he said worked for him, and the whole thing snowballed. Now suddenly they've found that he used a racial slur, and so there's increasing pressure even from the Biden administration, which should be standing for the First Amendment, to have Rogan silenced and deplatformed at Spotify. Meanwhile, there is, as you noted, Mehdi Hasan on MSNBC, who years ago famously likened non-Muslims to animals, to cattle, and spoke about them in the most disparaging terms. But because he is a leftist, and because to oppose such talk would be Islamophobia, he gets a free pass, and nobody is pressuring MSNBC to let him go. The double standing is glaring and obvious, but it's not even anything that embarrasses the left, because it's very clear that they are unapologetic about the fact that this is all about silencing dissenters and not really about removing hateful or offensive speech at all.
Regrettably, Robert Spencer, the Biden administration seems to be all in with this kind of behavior rather than standing with our First Amendment freedoms. And again, every single person in that administration has sworn an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States in exactly those words or similar ones, against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And the problem, of course, is some on the domestic side, and certainly many on the enemy side, the foreign side, are hard at the business of trying to silence us and suppress our understanding of the various threats that we're facing in these quarters. Nobody does a better job of documenting those threats than you, Robert Spencer, at jihadwatch.org. We're very, very appreciative of all that you do, and especially your visits with us here at Secure Freedom Radio. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, keep up that great work. I hope the rest of you will keep up your visits with us each weekday, same time, same station. Until then, we'll talk with you tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Last week, in a searing hour-long interview, a serving combat veteran Marine officer identified only as Paul told me about the destruction that is being inflicted upon our military by Biden's COVID-19 vaccination mandates, ideological purges, and other policies. The resulting enduring damage to the armed forces has become even more obvious with the revelation that the Pentagon leadership is now taking steps to conceal evidence of the physical harm tied to experimental gene therapies it has inflicted on our troops. As Conservative Review's brilliant Daniel Horowitz has documented, shocking data recently given Senator Ron Johnson by three Defense Department whistleblowers has been deceptively altered. The culture of the military and the servicemen and women's confidence in their superiors are essential to readiness and deterrence. We risk breaking both irreparably. God help us if we let that happen, as our enemies won't. This is Frank Gaffney.